And my guest on Podcasting Softly today is none other than a man I really, really admire. He is the boy from Illinois, came to Hollywood and made all of his dreams come true. He is Steve Latshaw. You know Steve from possibly the films he's directed, like Vampire, Trailer Park, Dark Universe, Biohazard, Alien Force, Jack O, Bikini Drive-In, Death Mask, Return of the Killer Shrews, or perhaps some of the films he's written, Gale Force, Crash Point Zero, Countermeasures, Scorpio One, Scorchers, Stranded, The Curse of the Komodo, Lightspeed, Planet Raptor, Command Performance, Megaconda. Steve, it's wonderful to have you on Podcasting Softly, sir.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you so much. I'll have to see some of those.
Yeah, they're great. I still have my copy of Vampire Trailer Park on video. So it.
And that's, if you're in Australia, that's a bootleg because it was only released in the United Kingdom and in Sweden. Those were the only two countries that got the joke.
Okay. Wow. That's great. I'm one of a kind. It's nice to know. Steve, mate, it's great to talk to you finally. Long time admirer, first time we're getting to chat. I know your story, a lot of people do, but we always take into account there's a lot of people out there listening that haven't heard of you, for whatever reason. So, I guess if we could start at the beginning, and give people just a little bit of, for those who came in late, how Steve Latshaw came to the movie business.
Well, I'd always wanted to get into it, and for the first 10 years of my career, I worked in broadcasting. I actually started in high school professionally in broadcasting in the 70s, but it was always, I wanted to make my own movies in the back of my mind. I went back to, I remember as a kid seeing a movie called Stanley, directed by Bill Capé in a theater, and reading about him shortly afterwards in a magazine called The Monster Times, and thinking, I know Hollywood's difficult to get into, maybe I should do what this guy did and start making monster movies in Florida first and then gradually move to California. In the late 1980s, I was in Orlando, Florida, working as a news entertainment reporter and also doing some acting. I was on the Superboy TV series, the second season. I did about 6 episodes and as a recurring character, as a resident newsman or news reporter whenever they needed someone for that. I got my SAG card, but I was always watching the directors and seeing how they blocked things out because I wanted to make films. I'd made some feature-length projects when I ran a cable TV station in the 80s in Illinois, and so that was always the goal. And I ended up making friends with Bill Capé after doing a news story on him, a sort of a career-spanning interview with him for the TV station I was working for, and then he sort of mentored me and helped me through the process, and we made Vampire Trailer Park in the summer of 1990, and then I also did a news story on Fred Olen Ray, and that became a very important relationship, and in 92, all the while working at this TV station, my partner Pat Moran and I went out to Los Angeles. Fred had actually published a book called The New Poverty Row, which was about director producers who also became distributors. The last chapter, Fred had written about himself, and it was one of the most inspirational chapters I've ever read. It was amazing some of the things he pulled off getting his career started. And towards the end of that chapter, he's talking about all these 16-millimeter action-adventure films that he's exec producing, he's financing for filmmakers around the country on a very low budget. So I told Pat, I said, we should go out to Los Angeles and pitch something to Fred. So we went out in the summer of 1992 and we pitched him some stories, including one called Swamp Monster, that was sort of first man in space set in the swamps of Florida. And he liked that story and a lot. And we ended up making a deal with him. And 3 or 4 weeks later, we actually had a contract and a first check to make a movie called Dark Universe. And at that moment, it's sort of like, now we actually have to do this. But it kind of snowballed from there. We ended up shooting on weekends, making 3 sci-fi horror features for Fred in Florida, Dark Universe, Biohazard, the Alien Force, and Jacko, all of which were extremely big home video hits domestically and around the world. And so we had a nice run there. And then we did Death Mask with Jimmy Dust, and then I moved down to California. So that's sort of how that all got started.
Right. And, I mean, when most people look you up, I mean, the primary thing you're listed as is a screenwriter, because you have a lot of screenwriting credits. Did writing sort of, I mean, I know that's the cheapest thing to do in the movie business, because all you need is a pen and a pencil, or a typewriter, and in this case is a word processor, but you seem to explode it as a screenwriter. What was that? You know.
Well, it was. I think it's the most important thing in the film business. I mean, the without a good script, you have nothing.
Right.
I was writing short stories when I was, you know, in single digits. So writing was always something I did. When I did the films with Pat Moran, Pat did the heavy lifting when it came to the writing. I would help with the scripts and I would help with the stories, but you know, I was focusing on other aspects. But when I got out to L.A., I finally moved to L.A. in the summer of 1995, fall, actually. I spent about a year trying to set up projects as a director around town.
Right.
What I had at that time was a reputation for being able to deliver an ultra low budget feature film for $100,000 or less on a very tight schedule, you know, 8 to 10 to 12 days, right. And it would be very commercial. So I had that rep. The only problem was by the fall of 1995, in the indie market, the demand for those kind of films had basically gone away. So I was an expert at something that they weren't making anymore.
Right.
So I spent about a year unemployed, and then in the fall of 1996, Fred, you know, came to the rescue again, and he said, "Hey, I'm getting ready to do this family film for Andrew Stevens called Invisible Dad. And do you want to get it? I know it's not directing, but do you want to give writing a shot?" And I said, "Sure, absolutely." So I pitched the story. Everybody liked it. I wrote the script. Everybody liked the script. They made the film. And I was like, here I go. I didn't expect to be a screenwriter, but there's a film.
Right.
And then Andrew Stevens really liked the writing I did for that. And he said, "I've got this action adventure film that I'm supposed to do with Jeff Steepman. It's sort of a spy adventure film, but it takes place in outer space."
Yeah.
He said, "I've got a script called Scorpio One, and it's kind of unfinished. Can you read it and tell me how you rewrite it?" So I read the script. The script was inadequate. Not a lot happened in it. The last 20 minutes of the film wasn't even written in the script. It was just sort of descriptions of, well, then this is going to happen, and this is going to happen, and this is going to happen.
Right.
And I told Andrew after reading it, I said, "Look, I can't rewrite this. There's nothing there." And he goes, "Oh." And I said, "But I do have an idea." I said, "Do you remember the Alistair MacLean novel and movie, Ice Station Zebra?"
Yeah.
And he said, "Yeah." And he said, it's a disaster at an Arctic station, and everybody from all over the world is rushing to get to the Arctic station to rescue everybody, fire this Arctic station. But what they're really after is secret microfilm. And so it's basically spies now." I said, "Why don't we do that in space?" So we ended up doing that story. It's a space station that's had a fire. Everybody's believed to be dead. Everybody's going to the rescue to see if they can find somebody. But what they're really after is a computer disk that has the secret of cold fusion. And Andrew liked the idea. He said, "We'll just run with it." So I went home that Christmas to visit the family, and I just wrote it. And I'm scared to death, because this is a bigger than normal film for me. It's going to have some real big stars in it for that level, and I just went nuts with it. I came up with the idea of having a veteran astronaut played by Steve Canale, who was a frustrated Apollo astronaut that never got to fly his mission because Nixon canceled the moon program.
Right.
And I came up with the idea of having escape pods on this space station that were old Apollo capsules so that they would have to, when they leave at the end of the film, they would have to escape in these escape pods and actually do a reentry and Apollo splashdown. I thought those were all neat touches, and I wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
And they shot the film, and Andrew loved the script, and Worth Keeter was the director and made a very good film out of it. Speakman, and it had Robert Carradine and Steve Canale and George Murdoch and Robin Curtis. So I was very proud of that. From that point on, I became their sort of go-to guy for what they called the hardware or action adventure films. So I wrote a lot of them for them.
No, I was just going to say it's ironic you brought that one up because that's one of my favorites of the ones you've written. Still got the VHS of that one too. But it's ironic that you brought that one up. That's what I was going to say. But the next thing I was going to do.
Alistair MacLean was a huge influence on me, and I just love those kind of adventure films where they have twists that you don't expect.
Yeah.
But it was a fun one to write, and I'm still sort of very proud of how that turned out. I really liked some of the scenes that Robert Carradine had, particularly towards the end.
Yeah,
there were some nice moments in there.
Yeah, and Jeff Speakman was one of those guys that they were trying to put out there back in the days when they had vehicles for everyone, and some of them stuck and some of them didn't, he was this new martial arts star back when they were trying to push every martial arts star into becoming a movie star. And he was good initially. I still love The Perfect Weapon, which was like the first sort of movie he exploded on the scene with. Not that it was a particularly original story. I mean, it was a pretty well rehashed story about this, this kid who was a delinquent and he learns martial arts and, he's got a problem with his father and, he's got to go and save the neighborhood, and really his martial arts saves the day and all that kind of thing. But, one thing I've always wanted to ask you, as a suffering screenwriter myself, is, the chain of, because you've done a lot of action type adventure movies, you've done big, stuff like Megaconda, Planet Raptor, Lightspeed, once you're in, it's easier, or does it never get easy? Like, you're always sort of struggling to get the next gig type thing.
Well, there's a great quote from one of my favorite directors, Burt Kennedy. He said every movie is like a rocket launch, and they only do so many rocket launches a year, and you're an astronaut, you have to try to figure out some way to get on it.
Right.
It's always a struggle.
Mm.
It's either feast or famine.
Right.
It's either they give you so many movies to do, you're writing so many movies at once. I think it was in 1999, I did 9 or 10 films that year. And just saying yes and then hoping to God you can figure out a way to get them done. Or there's not a lot of work at all. You have those fallow periods too because the market changes, the demands of the market change.
Right.
Suddenly the kind of thing that you're known for doing, they're not doing. So it's an up and down thing. It's always a struggle to find work, but you have to kind of find a way to take pleasure in the actual work itself. And I still enjoy the writing process, particularly if it's some project you're really excited about. It's a fun thing to do.
Yeah, and how has it been since the over there? Like, I've spoken to a lot of people in doing the show about how, the mid-ground has fallen away over there, and it's become increasingly difficult because there's really only sort of micro-budget films and big-budget films in the kind of the middle ground where you used to have where a lot of your credits kind of used to fall, that you know, low-budget middle ground type of action movie, which now has to be sort of put together independently via a lot of sources, because Hollywood isn't making sort of the mid-range, you know, movie anymore. What's it been like, you know, from your point of view?
I work as much as I'd like to work. I mean, it's the kind of films we were making in the late 90s and early 2000s. It was sort of a template for them. They were all made for about $1.5 million.
Right.
They all had stars attached to them. A lot of them used stock footage from other films, and we wrote around stock footage. I think the most egregious example, not gregarious, it's a long word. Egregious, is that the right word?
Uh-huh.
Example of movies was probably a movie I wrote for Jim Wynorski called Rangers.
Right.
I don't think that action set piece in it at all. All the big action pieces were from other movies. And it was kind of like the way, I don't know if you're familiar with the Republic serials.
I am a little bit, but yeah. But I know that Corman, Corman too used to do it with some of his pictures a lot.
The serials they made in the 50s towards the end of that era.
Right.
They basically based all their action scenes on stock shots from earlier things. So we did a lot of that.
Right.
But those were all movies that we were making with Michael Dudikoff and with Jeff Fahey and a lot of those actors, Jean-Claude Van Damme and Speakman and you know, the whole bunch. And the market kind of fell out for those kind of films in the early 2000s. In the mid to late 2000s, I did some micro-budget sci-fi films. I did some TV movies for the Sci-Fi Channel. I did some family films. But it was a different marketplace. It was different kinds of movies, different budget levels.
Right.
A lot of those films were done for around $500,000, like Planet Raptor and American Black Beauty and, you know, films like that. There was one I did at that time called Xenophobia, that's a Laurel, that's an Oliver Hardy movie. Xenomorph.
Mm-hmm.
It was shot in Romania back-to-back with Planet Raptor, and both directed by Gary Jones, who's a great guy.
Yeah.
And that film was never released because I think the producers weren't able to pay the effects bill for the last, so the Romanian hosts held on for the last 4 days of dailies, so that Xenomorph, it had C. Thomas Howell and Ron Silver in it. That never, to my knowledge, that has never been released. But
I think I did actually. I vaguely recall seeing a case for it. You know, because it was a.
So if you run across it,
yeah,
I would think Bill get a copy of it because I've never seen it. So
I'll have a look through my shelf because I vaguely. I'm pretty sure. Yeah, for whatever reason, it came out down here because I do remember watching something. It might be the same one, but I'll check anyway. I'll check anyway and get back to you. But,
yes, please do. After those, I think in the late 2000s, I did Megaconda, which was a micro-budget sci-fi film that was produced by Fred Ray and directed by his son Chris, who is now a prolific director on his own.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, working with Fred and then now Chris, who's just gone from strength to strength.
First of all, Fred started out as an employer.
Yeah.
And then a mentor, and now he's a close friend, and that's a friendship after, and it's almost 30 years now, I value greatly. So I have always enjoyed just hanging with Fred.
Yeah. And you work with You work with Big Jim too a couple of times. I'm a good friend of Jim Winorski.
I've known Jim for years. Jim's a fun guy too, and I've done six or seven films with Jim. And I've actually done another three or four for Jim that I didn't get credit for.
Oh, okay.
In Curse of the Komodo, he took the script for Curse of the Komodo.
Right.
And changed the, and he admitted this to me himself, he changed the character names and changed the monster, but used the same script for a movie he did called AI. As you know, played the bio monster in Biohazard.
Yeah.
Back in 1984, he came down to Florida.
Yeah.
But one day, I played it in our movie too. So, Chris, I've known since he was 15.
Yeah, I've always wanted to ask someone from the writer's perspective of working with Jim, because I mean I've spoken to Jim a number of times, but what's it like being the writer on one of his movies?
He's very involved in the script. He's very hands on. He usually has a pretty, in the case of Rangers, he had a pretty detailed outline because he had to figure out ahead of time how to make all the stock footage work. But in general, he comes up with an idea, you'll send him an outline, he'll tweak it. Once you get it ready, you start doing the script. And then once it gets to the script, he's usually very specific. He will call you up or come over and the notes will be very specific. You know, change this line, shorten this line. I mean, he's originally a writer. So he's very particular about the changes that he wants. He gets very involved in it all the way down.
Right, right.
He's also very conscious of the basic three-act structure. He likes to have sort of traditional beats in there and a big third act. And
seems like he's very good with budget too. I remember I was he was looking for an idea for a Bigfoot movie, and I had something and just an outline for one, and went through it and he liked it, but he said that's not really the way I want to go. I don't want to do a traditional sort of Bigfoot in the woods movie. I want to do something else. But then as I sort of started to pitch him other ideas, he really is a master of, like, he picked through that idea in an instance, and he said, no, that would cost too much, or, you know, as soon as you say this, that means, you know, that kind of, like, picking through it practically, like, okay, what can we can't afford to do that, and that would cost this amount of money, and that would, you know, that really...
He's very good at that, but what you have to understand in those days, by the time I was working with Jim and doing all those movies for Cinetel and for Royal Oaks and everything else, I sort of had to approach the writing like a producer.
Right.
Because by that point, I'm already knowing the rules of the game. I'm knowing that you have to set the bulk of the movie, you have to find a location that you can sort of live at because you want to avoid company moves. I know how to keep the cast leveled down in terms of the number of speaking parts, how to find locations that can double for most multiple different things, how to write, you know, don't put too many night sequences in there, how to match the stock shots. So I'm already walking into it. I'm not going to suggest or put things in a script that's going to cost money. I mean, by the time we got to that point, I sort of knew the rules of the game, so that wasn't really an issue.
Okay,
Most of the stuff that I did with Jim, the corrections would simply be, you know, dialogue changes, or
right.
He would suddenly say, hey, I found this great section of stock footage, change this and rewrite this and add this. So that's kind of how that worked.
Yeah. So when you go from, say, writing like that to something where, you know, you're not primarily going to be responsible for, or working with someone that is responsible for those parameters where you can just write, you know, with, you know, you have your head of steam and write the movie you just want to write, not thinking about how much it's going to cost and all that sort of thing. What, you know, do you Do you still find yourself influenced by all that sort of thing, or do you just really have the head of steam and charge into it and just write a cool movie you just want to write, you know?
It depends on the progress or the project. I don't...
Like if you were going to write a spec or
something. I wrote a screenplay a couple of years ago that was a... that I was very fond of. It's set in 1950s, based on a true story. It's about... the entertainer Al Jolson's trip to Korea in 1950 to entertain the troops over there. And it was an intense trip, and he was an older man, and he got very sick in the course of the show. He gave out all these great shows, entertained these young soldiers, but he came back to California after that tour, and within a month he was dead. And I mean, it was a tour that killed him, and it's a fascinating historical story.
Right.
And I didn't really think in terms of budget with that. It's still not. I think probably reading the script now, I know there's some things, some tricks that I knew how to stage it so that it wouldn't be crazy expensive. I mean, it's still something that could be shot relatively inexpensively. So some of that sticks with me, I guess. But I didn't really put those kind of parameters on myself. What I basically try to do is focus on, I'm a big one on structure, and I will do a very detailed step outline before I start the script, where I've got maybe 35 to 40 major scenes. Each of them will have a page count, so that I've really got a roadmap of the entire movie, and then I will start the script. And
right.
Once I start the script, I have a limit of how many pages I will do a day, and I don't stop to revise. I just go until I finish.
Right.
And I was heavily influenced by, that's how Ian Fleming used to write. He'd
right.
get up every morning and he'd write for 2 hours or whatever, and as he put it, would vomit it out on the page, and, you know, he'd do the revisions once he'd finished the first draft of his novel. So I took the same approach.
Right. Since I saw it, it was great to see your name again, and a great sort of tongue-in-cheek actioner and command performance. I know that probably people bring it up a lot, but I really enjoyed that movie.
So I was very happy with that film and with that experience. I was originally approached by, actually, Andrew Stevens, I think in around 2007, approached me. And said he was involved in a film that Dolph Lundgren was directing down in Texas called Missionary Man. And they needed a rewrite. And he sent me the script to read it, and then he said, I'm going to put you in touch with Dolph. So, I read the script. Dolph sent me the concept art booklet that they created, which was very ornate. And I read it, and I sent the notes to Dolph about what changes that I think maybe they should make, but I said, you know, it's almost ready to shoot. I said, I'm cutting myself out of the gig here, but I wouldn't want to take your money to rewrite this because it's almost there. So that was the end of that.
Right.
But, you know, I had to be honest. I wasn't going to take the money under false pretenses. They didn't need me. And then about a year later, I got a call from Dolph and goes, hey, I've got an opportunity to do a film at least partially in Russia. I'm in L.A. If you want to meet, I want to do a project with you. So I went down to L.A. to the W, which is a big hotel in West Hollywood that he likes to stay at. It's all steel and glass, very European. I was at the lunch, the dining room, and for lunch, and he was very personable, very nice guy, very polite, very fun. Does a wicked Sylvester Stallone invitation. You know, I learned about him as a huge fan of Clint Eastwood, and emulates him, and managed to do in a perfect imitation. He did all of Eastwood's lines from Unforgiven.
Right.
But he had three stories. He said, I've got three treatments here that I've written, all that could be done with this Russia connection, in at least part in Moscow. And he said, sit here, have some coffee on me, read through them, and tell me which one you'd like to do. So he went upstairs, and I sat there, and I read all three of them, and I came back down, and I said, this one about the ex-biker who can kick ass, who he's now a rock and roll drummer backing up a Madonna-type star in the Soviet Union and called Command Performance. He said, this looks like fun. I'd like to do this. He says, great. So we talked about it, and we both wanted to do something that was sort of retro, sort of a throwback to the 80s and 90s action movies that was fun. He didn't want his character to be, the standard ex-military guy. He liked the idea that he was a biker guy that, happened to know how to use weapons and fist combat because he'd been just a tough guy and was a stoner and had a sense of humor and but always loved rock and roll and somehow fell into becoming a rock and roll drummer and was now successful at it around Europe. It was a crazy concept for a character, but we thought we would have a lot of fun with it. So I read the treatments again. Normally, when you have an actor approach you and say, I want to write a script for you, you figure, I'm going to do most of the heavy lifting. But this treatment is 20 pages of detail. I mean, the story was blocked out extremely well. There was a lot of backstory involving the fall of the Soviet Union and certain hardline elements that were sort of on the sidelines, wanting to sort of get that back in place. And there's a lot of, terrorists, and there's a lot of elements in that. And basically what we did is I did the first draft. It was pretty good, but it was a little long. It was about 120 pages long. And Dolph said, okay, I'll take a pass on it. And then he did a second draft. And I remember opening it up when he sent it to me. It was 90 pages. And I thought, oh my God, what good stuff of mine has he cut out. No. And I read it, and he hadn't cut any of my good stuff out. He trimmed it, he weeded it, but the good stuff was still there, and I thought, this guy's really a writer. He knows his stuff. And we ended up spending about a year and doing, off and on, and doing three or four more drafts and polishes on it, and then finally he set up a deal with I think, Avi Lerner at Millennium, and they made the film. And the film turned out great. I knew we had a winner when Dolph invited me and my then fiance, now wife, back to his, a year or so later, back to his hotel at the W, just before the AFM, to show us the first cut. And it was just great. So, very happy with that film and the way it turned out. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was great. Fantastic. Look, Steve, I could talk to you for hours about all of the stuff that you've done, but we better devote some time to Killer Shrews. not that that's any of the lesser material, but David would be pissed at me if I, if we don't bring up the Killer Shrews.
Well, I'm also trying to push this movie, so.
Yeah. But what's funny is David sent it to me and said, do you want to talk to Steve? And I was like, oh, of course I want to talk to Steve. But it wasn't until I started watching Return of the Killer Shrews when I realized I'd already seen it. Because it was released over here not as Return of the Killer Shrews, but as Mega Rats. I don't know if you know that. It was released
Here's what happened.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it was released over here as Mega Rats.
Great title.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, I mean, it has the same art as some of the other ones, but yeah, Mega Rats. And I went, hey, this is Mega Rats. But, yeah, so I was very surprised. But anyway, yes, it is a return, and I actually have seen and have a very, very old copy, which I taped off television on a videotape of the 1959 original film.
Mm-hmm.
Let me
first of all tell you about the original release of this film.
Yep.
We shot the film in 2011.
Yep.
We finished the effects in 2012. And I believe it came out in Australia. I think Australia was the actual first DVD release of it.
Okay, wow.
In Australia.
Yeah.
And, it was, I think that was the summer of 2013. We were with a distributor, American World Pictures, owned by Mark Lester, And we told him at the time, we said, please don't market this as a straight horror film, because it's not. It's a comedy. It's a send-up of with our CGI alone, is bad, intentionally bad. You can't do great CGI on the budget that we had. The intent was to do a send-up of Sci-Fi Channel movies that creature feature movies that were very big at the time.
Right.
They don't use so much of more, but the idea was to send those films up, whether it be the Sharknado films or whatever, and also do kind of a gentle homage to the old drive-in movies.
Right.
The '50s and sixties, but it was obviously a comedy. I mean, our film has a guy in a boat suit, for God's sake. So that was what we told them, and we said, if you sell this as a straight horror film, it's not going to sell very well. Like, nobody can see it. Well, they insisted. They did some beautiful key art that is nothing like what the film is. And they sold it as a straight horror film, and they sold some territories on DVD only. Just a handful of territories, Australia. They did a few European territories, and they had it for 18 months, and basically did very little bit, sort of no TV sales to speak of, nothing. So we took back the domestic DVD rights, and we held on to the streaming, video on demand, all of those rights. We held on to most of the rights, and we said, okay, once we got the rights back to everything, we said, we're just going to sit on this for a while, because it's a film that, by and large, hasn't been seen by a lot of people. It wasn't sold very far, very much. Let's just sit on it and see how the market changes. We made a side deal with Fred Olen Ray through his Retro Media Company, and he put out a spectacular DVD that was filled with extras. He really went to town on it for us, did a tremendous job. We even included the original Killer Shrews as a bonus feature. And we stuck that out, and they did a few thousand units domestically, and then basically the film disappeared. And then this year, suddenly the market has changed. The big thing now is, these platform releases, iTunes, Netflix, all these different platforms. That's how everybody's wanting it. We thought, we should put this out and market it as the comedy that it is. And
right.
Went back to our original, very retro arts, and that's what we did. And what we're finding so far, as various platforms pick it up and the attention we're getting, is that people don't know this movie exists, which is great, because it's finally going to be able to find its audience now that people know what it is.
Yeah, exactly. Well, my wife hadn't seen it, and it was presently, because she's a huge Dukes of Hazzard fan, so I said, you're gonna be happy, because it's got Roscoe P. Coltrane in it, and
John Schneider, Rick Hurst, who played Cletus on the Dukes of Hazzard. It was very much a family production. Jennifer Lyons, who was our female lead, had a part in the first Dukes of Hazzard reunion movie back in 1996. So it was very much a family relationship there. It's not a Dukes of Hazzard film, but there is one scene in there you probably remember where we have a couple of nods, let's say, to the Dukes of Hazzard, sort of subtle nods. And a couple of scenes. One in particular where Jimmy and John Schneider and Rick Hurst are hanging out at a bar out in the jungle. But those fans are out there too, and so
yeah.
That'd be a huge fan.
Bruce Davidson looks like he always, from the first time I saw it, and then again when I watched it again the other night, Bruce Davidson looks like he's having a marvelous time in this movie.
It's very funny about Bruce. We had interviewed a number of different actors for that part, and we got turned down by a couple. I even sat down and spent 2 hours with Robert Blake talking about doing that film. Bruce, we were 2 days from starting to shoot and 3 days from that character Jerry's first scene. And Bruce's name came up, and I was a huge fan. And I said, well, gee, I don't know if we can get him, but let's talk. So we made an offer to his agent and didn't hear anything all day. And then the very next day was the last day before we were starting to shoot. And we're literally getting to late afternoon, and I got a phone call from a guy I had never talked to before that was Bruce's manager. I was in a Vaughn's supermarket at 5:30, and I get this phone call from Bruce's manager. He says, oh, I've been trying to find you. I said, Bruce really wants to do this. And I said, oh, really? He goes, yeah, he loves the script. I said, he loves our script. Well, that's great. So the deal was rapidly made, and Bruce showed up on set. We started production, I think we might have even started on a Monday now that I think about it. Bruce showed up. No, it was a Friday. And then Bruce showed up Saturday at Bronson Canyon for the first day there. And I don't remember. But so and one of the first shots up today, I'm at Bronson Canyon, legendary Bronson Canyon. My first shot of the day is with Bruce Davison. And I'm intimidated because I've been watching this guy in movies since I was a kid. I walk up to him and I said, introduce myself. He goes, so I guess you guys wanted me for this because of Willie, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, yeah, but I go back to like old Xana's Raid, and I said I was a big fan of the movie Dead Man's Curve about the surf girl Jana Dean. He played Dean Torrance in that film, and I told him, I've known Dean Torrance for decades and I'm a huge fan of that movie, and we got to talking. But I'm still dealing with, this is Bruce Davison. He's an Academy Award nominated actor.
Sure,
asked me how to do his performance, and he says, so, do you mind if I do this? And he does this funny thing with his mouth.
Yeah.
And he said, I did that in Willie. Can I do that? And I said, well, sure. And then he goes, how about this? I had this line in Willard. I said, tear him up! He says, can I do that? And I said, sure. So from that point on, it was great. We had a ball, and he had so much fun. And I said to him at one point, I said, Bruce, you seem to be having a real good time because it's great. He said, because the rest of the cast does all my setup lines, and I get to come in and do the punchline. So he was wonderful.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite moments were the scenes that he did with Jimmy Betts, because you had these two old pros working together and just feeding off each other. It was wonderful.
Yeah. When I think of him, I always think of that, maybe because I watched it again recently, but I always think of that scene in Shortcuts where Jack Lemmon plays his father. And he's sitting there, and his father basically tells him about the time, you know, how he cheated on his mother. Like, you know, he went over to this woman's house to tell her, and she said, you know, she asked her to help fix the sink, and she's like pouring, she keeps offering him beers till they're both drunk. And then, you know, it's a great scene. Bruce doesn't really do much in the scene because it's really Jack Lemmon's scene. But just his, like, he's got these great reactions, like, and because he's eating cereal, you know, because he's been there all night because his son is in hospital. His son's going to die. His son's in hospital, and he's just sitting there, and he's just playing with the cereal. And slowly he stops what he's doing, and he's just really listening to his father finally. And his father's telling this story, and, you know, because his father, you know, was an absent father and an alcoholic and all this sort of stuff. And it's a really great scene. And Bruce doesn't do much in the scene. Like, he doesn't, you know, doesn't say much, doesn't really do much. But as they say, some actors are really good at stillness. And he's certainly one of them. But marvelous.
Well, we had an interesting moment with him. It was on his last day. And we're shooting literally the sort of a climactic scene as the shrews are coming, and you know they're going to get ready to blow up the shrews, and he's got James Best is dragging him along this path, and they have a confrontation scene, and as originally written it was about a page and a half of dialogue. And Bruce says, you know, why don't we cut out all this and we just have this little exchange here? And a page and a half became, I think, two lines, and it was distilled down to the two of them, you know, facing off each other, and Bruce says, "I'll see you in hell." And Jimmy says, "I don't think so. I'm heading north."
Right, right.
And just a page and a half down to those two lines and the looks that they were both throwing in and stuff Bruce was in. And it worked perfectly. And the rest of it was superfluous. We didn't need it. And Bruce knew that instinctively, you know, and so let's distill it down to just this. That was great. So it's when you're working with somebody like that, they make your job so easy.
Right, yeah. Casting is the battle, eh? You cast the right actors, you can just let them go because they know their job.
Yeah, we had great, our whole cast in this film was wonderful.
Yeah.
So we were very fortunate.
Well, it's wonderful to see it back out and around. Return of the Killer Shrews, ladies and gentlemen. For those listening here down under, you probably remember it as Mega Rats, but it's back as Return of the Killer Shrews. But it's great to see. Steve, mate, I could talk to you all day. I've been waiting so long to have a chat with you, but I've taken up way too much of your time this morning. It's wonderful to see that you're still putting things out. I wish you all the best with all the projects that you've got going. You've been a real inspiration.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been a delight talking to you. I'll be happy to do your show anytime.
It's fantastic. But, so everyone check out. Where is it streaming right now, Return of the Killer Shrews?
This will be available for pre-sale for iTunes on October 12th.
Right.
Debuts on iTunes exclusively on October 22nd, and then it goes to Amazon and Google on November 9th, and then it will just spread like wildfire from there.
Totally.
At some point next year, we'll be doing a big Blu-ray edition of it. So
that'll be really cool. Everyone, check it out. Return of the Killer Shrews. My guest has been Steve Latshaw. It's been absolutely fantastic talking to you, sir. Check out all of Steve's movies. Check out Return of the Killer Shrews, even if you have seen Mega Rats. The film formerly known as Mega Rats is back. Return of the Killer Shrews. Steve, thank you for being on Podcasting Softly, I should say.
Thank you.
Thank you. Tremendous.